build the kind of world we want to live in? It's a question that goes right to the heart of the Divided Selves exhibition at the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum. And it's one that artist, architect and activist Sophia Karim looks at from a very literal perspective. From the exploitation of migrant construction workers to the power play present in the design of prison cells, Sophia's focus is on areas where her architectural practice and human rights campaigning overlap. For the first episode of our Divided Selves podcast, she spoke to us about the politics of architecture and how buildings tend to uphold the values and power structures of the societies that produce them. Produced from 2021 onwards, An Architecture of Disappearance is a series of small architectural models inspired by conversations with political prisoners.
I've had been working as a professional architect for over 20 years. That was my career, you know, really safe career in big, medium-sized architectural practices. And in 2018, I was dissatisfied with that career. Well, I had been dissatisfied for a long time and knew I wanted to change and explore my own ideas and thoughts and passions, I suppose. And I really didn't know how, and I really didn't know if I would succeed or not, but I went freelance from my job. And then a few months later, my uncle, who's a photographer and human rights activist, Shahidul Alam, was jailed by the government of Bangladesh after he reported on student protests. And I began campaigning for him alongside thousands of others. And it turned into a global campaign. And I think at that point, I became an activist. And he was released. But by this stage, I was now campaigning on other things and for other political prisoners. And my art, architecture, and that all merged.
So let's talk a little bit about how those things kind of merged and how your architectural practice kind of came to figure as part of this interest in political prisoners.
The platform I run is called Turbine Bug because it started as a protest for the Turbine Hall in solidarity with Shaheen Bug. But it's a platform for political art. So many artists and activists send me work, which I share on that platform. And their medium is whatever it is. So it might be photography, drawing, whatever. And you won't see much of my work on that platform. But my work, my training is as an architect, and it's really the only language I know and that I have. If I had been trained as a writer, I would be using words. If I'd been training as a painter, I'd be using paint. And so, although I had never used this language to talk about these things, I really had no choice, and it would be my default. Every time I tried to express myself, it would come out in some architectural form. And it was a strange experience because I'm kind of the hinterland of using this language. I have no grounding for how to use the language. I just have to follow instinct. But I think what I know is that the very first night that my uncle was abducted, 30 or so plainclothes police officers arrived at his door and took him away. And we didn't know very much, but as details began to emerge, I understood that he'd been tortured, he'd been blindfolded, he'd been made to walk up and down stairs with heavy objects on his head. He was in pain. So in the day, I'd be very busy campaigning, writing emails, contacting, you know, organizations. And at night, I began to dream in terms of space and think about, process everything in terms of space. So sometimes I began to see spaces I'd never seen before. So one thing I was doing was very consciously, I was trying to construct the prison that he was in my mind from fragments of information we had. And I think I was doing that because I wanted to enter and be with him and hold his hand. And then the other things would happen more subliminally. So I'd see spaces that were mainly made of emotion or colour, and they would expand and contract and expand, and they had no scale. And I didn't know what this was, and I wondered, is that maybe what happens when you're blindfolded? Maybe that's what happens to space. I don't know. Is that what happens to space when you're confined? And so I began to sort of see these forms, and it really was a turning point in the way I interpret architecture and space. As I began campaigning for other political prisoners and writing to them in prison, sometimes I would use things that they told me in architectural designs. And some of that work we can talk about is here. So specific things about their stories would then enter my architectural designs.
Can you give me maybe an example of one of the stories that you kind of worked into one of the pieces on display here?
Yeah, I can. A couple of the samosa packets you might see are about the BK16 prisoners in India. And they're a group of 16, a few have been released now, intellectuals, human rights activists, poets, a Jesuit priest who died, jailed in India at the moment. One of them, Aaron Ferreira, who's a lawyer and a human rights defender, wrote a book of prison memoirs called Colours of the Cage. Quite a few of them are held in a maximum security cell called Under Cell. Under means egg. So it's an egg-shaped cell or complex, prison complex. And they're often held in long periods of solitary confinement in this cell. And Aaron Wright wrote in his memoirs about when you enter these cells. And he talked about going through a door which you have to stoop to enter because it's low. And the prison guards won't belittle themselves by entering this door. They enter another door with their head held high. Aaron also talks about the Lal Gate, which means red gate. And it's the red exit gate that the prisoners all dream of. And he said it's the overriding symbol of hope and despair, this red exit gate that appears in rhetoric, in their small talk, in their dreams. So one of the models you'll see in the exhibition is a tall, thin space, which is said to be the proportions of one of these undercells, although there are various accounts of the dimensions of these, but it's a tall, thin space. And you enter on one side, there's a small door. So an average height adult would have to stoop to enter through that door. But a child wouldn't. And I designed it for a child. So a child would be able to enter through that door without stooping. Similarly, Professor Sai Baba, who's 90% disabled and is confined in Under Cell in prison, he's in a wheelchair. Someone in a wheelchair wouldn't need to stoop to enter that door. And then on the other side of this tall, thin space, there's a very tall red glass door. And that's Red Gate, the exit gate, where you can walk out with your head held high. And at certain points of day, light comes through that tall red glass door and it casts a shaft of light that cuts across the space. And it's this thin, tall space. I think it's like 3 meters wide, but about 9 meters tall, which is an unusual space. It's a thin place. One political prisoner who I was campaigning for, Professor Anontel Dumde, who amazingly was released a couple of months ago. I was writing to him from an island in Scotland called Iona. And Iona is said to be a thin place. So I think in sort of Celtic mythology and belief, there's this idea of a thin place where the boundary between the physical world and the spiritual world is said to be thin and you can dissolve from one to the other. And I sent Professor Del Dumde drawings from that island. And every morning I would cycle to this very small, very basic chapel on the island and light candles for the BK16 prisoners. And I sent him drawings of that chapel and wrote to him about thin place. And I wrote, perhaps drawings are thin places. a means to escape into the other world. Maybe that's why I send you drawings, I don't know. And then he wrote back to me, and he had drawn a little picture of the sparrows outside his cell. And he wrote, I think drawings are thin places. They're places where we can metamorphosize. And so that is also why in that model it has these very thin, tall proportions. And the other thing that came into that model was that there was a Syrian poet who was jailed, and he had written in one of his poems, oh, how the narrowness of this space shames me.
Yeah, I love that idea of like escaping through drawings. I was listening to something recently that was about, somebody in a German prisoner of war camp who'd kind of almost been like composing a book in his head while he was in there, and that was kind of like his escape. So
wow,
yeah. And also, like, there's something quite interesting, isn't there, about that sort of thinness that you were talking about, particularly in the context of some of these people being imprisoned around religious differences, maybe just
yes, because also one of the BK16 prisoners, so the co-accused of Aaron Ferreira, who wrote about the Lyle Gate, the co-accused of Dr. Anand Dildumde, who has been released, was Father Stan Swamy, who was an 84-year-old Jesuit priest and tribal activist. And the other model that you'll see on the plinth in my exhibition is a small shelter I made, a garden room, and it was based around Father Stan Swamy, and on it's made of paper, and on the paper you can see texts from his medical bail hearing, because it was May 2021 and he was in a very bad way. He believed he would die. And when I made that model, he was trying for medical bail. He didn't get medical bail. He died. And I was extremely distressed. And I would still, with my mind, enter that model. And that model appears in this exhibition.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about kind of the process of going from these ideas that you're getting from those prisoners and those people to these models. So is the idea to sort of recreate what they're telling you, or is it to kind of turn it into something different, perhaps, something more positive?
The truth is, I don't know that I have an agenda as such. I think it just comes out the way it comes out, and I don't necessarily know why it comes out in the way it comes out. So one of the models you'll see there, it was a scheme, a very kind of standard scheme for residential development, 10 flats in Dulwich. It never happened because the site got sold. Now, a site like that, no one really is interested in you talking about political prisoners. They probably would run a mile. But so I don't explicitly say that it's anything to do with that. But I think, as I was saying before, because this is my only language, it can't help but come out. And so in that model, you'll see a series of small yellow gardens interspersed. There's a courtyard and a few terraces and on the roof. And I know in my mind that I was thinking yellow kept appearing again and again in my work, because the first cell my uncle was held in, quite terrifyingly and horribly, was called Sunflower Cell. And in that cell, he was having flashbacks, jaw pain, watery eyes. He was in a terrible way. And that's now appeared in that model. And then another example I can give is Professor Sai Baba, who's the one that's 90% disabled, and he's confined in this under cell. I wrote to him and I asked him, what's your favourite colour? And he wrote back and he said, I don't see any colours from my cell apart from the iron rusty bars, but the colour I dream of is parakeet green. That's the colour of earth. That's the colour of freedom that I long to see. So after that, I didn't consciously decide how that's going to appear in my work. I just left it there. And then eventually it starts to appear in my work. So I was designing a library, and in the corner near a dirt floor, quite low down, there's a window with green glass. Another building I was designing, we didn't have very much money for materials. I had proposed a very basic white brick. And I thought, how about if the mortar is parakeet green? And, you know, instead of using an expensive brick, which you don't have the money for, it's quite interesting to think about a very plain brick, but the mortar is interesting. But also architecturally, that's interesting. It would catch one's eye, because I'm not going to be around to explain why I've done whatever move in a building. Why is that window green? Why is the mortar green? Someone has to find delight from the building itself. When the light comes at a certain time, there'll be green light scattered on a surface, and that would bring delight, and it would speak for itself. I don't need to say why I've done what I've done. So these are ways that it appears. And that thing about the parakeet green and the window in the library, I wrote to Professor Sai Baba and said, these are ways that your parakeet green is starting to come into my work.
It's amazing. The way that it goes on that journey from there to like being in a building, like you say, where people aren't going to know what that is. That's such a fascinating like process to go
through. I think one thing is for me that it's been quite a journey as an artist and an activist as well, because I think initially my work was a lot more direct in its messaging. So, you know, a lot of activist art, if one wants to call it like that, people imagine it to be, and sometimes it is quite direct in its messaging, almost proselytizing, and that's fine. And you know, some of my work is like that, and some work needs to be like that, because every civil rights resistance movement has needed that kind of art. And ultimately, one has to be very clear about one's message in this. It's a matter of life and death. But also, I think, as I've progressed, another side of my work is much more inward and not so explicit about meaning. And I don't always know the meaning, and things aren't so black and white. And it might also be to do with my own struggle or my own distress. So sometimes at the most distressing times, it's still architecture that I will revert to. And it would be things like light or colour that would calm me down. I think architecture very much lends itself to talking about things without necessarily prescribing meaning. And one thing I've realized through reading the poems that, say, Sai Baba has written in jail is that meaning's not always clear, and the way he uses language is highly sophisticated as an art form. There are these strange, visceral landscapes that he creates. And they're also about love. I mean, I wrote to his wife and I said that his poems taught me a lot about love. And I mean, political love, communal love, romantic love. And that's a big part of my work and thinking as well.
I'm really interested in how this feeds into sort of architecture more generally. So you said something along the lines of, I can't remember what the exact quote was, but it was to do with feeling like architects needed to interrogate the politics of what they're making a bit more. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, and what are some of the things that you think need to be thought about by architects in that way?
Yeah, so in my over 20 years in professional practice, I can't recall a single conversation or meeting about the treatment of migrant workers. And yet I knew I learned it most from the photographs of my uncle, who had documented the lives of Bangladeshi migrant workers who were working on buildings in the Middle East and in Asia. What a terrible and huge issue it is, and the exploitation that happens. And so there'd be some conversations around this in kind of architectural theory and architectural press. And, you know, Zaha Hadid was questioned, and other architects were questioned about human rights issues in relation to architecture. But never once in the office did I encounter a single conversation about that. And then I'd see photographs from sites of buildings I'd worked on in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere, where I'd see migrant workers who seemed clearly to me to be Bangladeshi. And I'd think, these are my people. And I knew, like my uncle had told me, that some of them will never be allowed back in those buildings that they've designed. And increasingly, I realised how apolitical many architects are. Not all architects. There are some who, and we can talk about that later, you know, some architects who really certainly do care and consider these issues. But generally, the kind of neoliberalist move in architecture, it's highly capitalist, highly self-service, developer-driven. And I realised that what we were designing wasn't so much buildings as just adverts for buildings, these superficial buildings that really have nothing to do with the human condition.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. I actually saw something just the other day that was obviously not in the kind of scale that you're talking about, but just, you know, with like residential places in America or the UK or whatever, and just they kind of come to an architect with this as the space and how to kind of think about that in a more human-centric way than perhaps people often do, just in terms of the placing of different things, because certain things are fire traps and stuff, and it's just about kind of cramming everything in quite often.
Very often. I mean, what I can tell you is that in the places I worked, from the moment you will be drawing that napkin sketch of the building from the beginning, what you're really drawing is how to create a form which maximises a developer's profit. Every architectural move, and this has actually been tuned to a very sophisticated degree, and now they could probably get a computer to do it, and I think there are computer programs that do it and would probably do it much more efficiently. But every move you do is about maximising a developer's profit, and even considerations of human joy or entertainment or pleasure are through that lens. So we have to provide some human pleasure because then we get more profit, more people will buy this. So even pleasure, desire, everything is channeled through that lens. And that's why I describe those buildings as adverts for buildings. They're about lifestyle, living the right way, fulfilling these aspirational dreams, which are essentially capitalist dreams.
Cool. So you sort of touched on it a little bit, but you mentioned that there are some people that you think are kind of starting to address some of these issues in your field. Did you want to talk a little bit about that and where you think things are going? What would you hope the future for architecture to be in that way?
Yeah, so I think the climate emergency has shifted things a lot. So I think many architects have become a lot more socially conscious because of climate emergency. They're still not particularly human rights conscious, but what happened was that a lot of the kind of discourse around architecture began to question this method of making buildings, saying that if the planet is to survive, can we continue to produce buildings as capitalism prescribes? Where I notice a lot of difference is amongst the students. So I sometimes teach, and when I was studying architecture, it was very much about iconic architecture. You know, things like Frank Gehry's Guggenheim had come, and it was Zaha Hadid, and it was about these iconic buildings. Now the students, I see that that's very different. So a lot of them are much more socially engaged, working as collectives, talking about reuse of buildings, working with communities. Should we even be building a new building? How can we reuse what we have? And how can we engage the local community a lot more? And that's really encouraging. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of greenwash. So many buildings will win 5-star sustainability ratings. And yet you know that migrant workers have been exploited. Some may even have died on the construction of those buildings. So I can tell how serious an architect really is about climate emergency by their position on human rights within architecture. For me, you can't talk about one without the other.
You've been listening to episode one in a series of podcasts from the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum, delving into the stories behind its Divided Selves exhibition. The exhibition is free to visit until the 24th of September 2023. The curators are Hamad Nasser, Rosie Addenbrook and Alice Swatton. In our next episode, we'll be back with Sophia Karim to discuss Turbine Bag, a series of paper samosa packets with a powerful political message.